Looking in, I don't wanna be left on the outside.
Let me tell you that it hurts,
hurts so bad.
Hurts so bad.
Not so long ago, you broke my heart in two. Tears on my pillow.
As we have discovered today, folks, we are talking to the person known as Little Anthony. Little Anthony, it seems kind of odd to call you Little Anthony at this point in your life, but how about if I call you Anthony?
Well, that's good. No, nobody calls me Little Anthony, this Anthony. You know, it's not about my stature, how big I am, because I'm actually around 5'8" and a half. I think when you get older, you're supposed to get shorter, right? I don't know what I am now, but I'm not considered actually little. That's just a tag, a name, and I can explain that later on how that happened.
Well, let's start with, first of all, I am just absolutely delighted to have you on the program today, and I'd like to start with your beginnings, where you were born. I think Brooklyn kind of rings a bell. Does it ring a bell for you?
Well, it rings a bell. And I spent most of my life in Brooklyn, at least my young life. But actually, I was born, I was told by my mother, on 98th Street and Central Park West in New York City.
Okay.
But I only stayed there a minute, and I moved. It was during the war, I was told. My dad, Thomas, he got a job in the Brooklyn Navy Yard, and he moved the family to Brooklyn. And I think I was about 2 years old or a year or something like that, and then I lived in Brooklyn for a very long time after.
And what part of Brooklyn, New York, did you live in?
Well, you know, if you're familiar, I know a lot of people are transplants, and wherever you go, you find somebody from Brooklyn. I lived in Fort Greene Projects, right next to Marcy Projects, where Jay-Z comes from, off Myrtle Avenue and Flatbush.
Okay.
Flatbush Avenue, the famous Flatbush Avenue.
Gotcha.
So,
well, tell us a little bit about what life was like as you were growing up in the Fort Greene Projects. I don't know that folks today really know what that world was like for you.
Well, the funniest thing is I had a great support system. I had my aunts who lived in Harlem, my Aunt Bessie, Aunt Sarah, Aunt Shorty. That's my mom's sisters. And my mother, my father, my Aunt Naomi. It was like, you know, in fact, in those days, families usually lived in the same area.
Mm.
Today, the families are like nuclear. They're all over the place. Like,
right.
I got a son in Seattle. I got a daughter in New York City. I got another daughter in North Orlando, Florida. But in those days, everybody basically lived in the same block. And there's a whole story about that, how that became. And then now, as the modern times came, families kind of split up and were a bit different than it was in those days. So.
But
it was pretty cool. It was, and then I didn't, you know, I was. People ask, "Oh, you lived in the projects?" Well, at that time, the projects were government owned; they were not city owned.
Okay.
So they didn't become the hood yet.
I got you.
And it was.
So it was pre-hood days.
Culturally mixed.
It was culturally. It was pre-hood days.
Yeah. It was culturally mixed because everybody that was in that project that was supplied by the United States government worked at in the Brooklyn Navy Yard in one capacity or another. So there were Italians, there were Jews, there were Irish, you name it, man. Everybody was all over the place. In fact, I found somebody sent me a picture of a picture of all the kids, took a big picture in Fort Greene, where I used to live, in 146 North Elliott Walk. And it was just amazing looking at all the different cultures, all the different people. But, you know, after the city took it over, then it predominantly became more Puerto Rican, that kind of thing.
You know, it's interesting that you make that point, because so many times when we hear the word projects, we automatically think African-American, Latino, period, end of story. So it's interesting to hear that when you were living in the projects, it was really, it sounds like, to accommodate the workplace so that folks were close to work.
Yeah, that's what it was. It was culturally diverse, and, you know, so everybody worked there. In fact, I can remember my friends. One of them was Bobby Fasano, Italian kid. He used to live upstairs, and little Tommy used to live under me. He was a Jewish kid. And then, let me see, I can't remember how old it was, so many of them. And so, you know, when you're not that age, you don't know.
Yeah.
You don't have anything, any reference to say, hey, I'm not supposed to be here. You know, everybody right. that I knew were my friends. And we ate in each other's house and all that stuff. And after the war, that entirely changed. And slowly it became the hood. You know, so at that time, I was just about getting ready to, you know, I was in my teenage age, sort of like 14, 15 years old. And I was going to Boys High, one of the most prolific schools in the state, actually. And I was going there. And so then it began, you could see the change begin at that point.
Now, before you got to Boys High, and Boys High certainly was very well known, it's still in Brooklyn, you mm-hmm. talked about your early years being very much involved with music, and just kind of that was almost your best friend, it sounds like. In fact, at one point in a book that's recently been released about you, Little Anthony, My Journey, My Destiny, you say that you made friends with your voice. What did you mean by that?
Well, you know, I had a great imagination. I still do. I mean, my mother used to say, I don't know, she used to tell my aunt, I don't know about that boy, it's strange, he'd be in the room, and it sounded like there's three or four people in there. I had my imaginary friends, I had my singing friends, but the classic music, here's another thing, and since you said that, now my brain is working, I'm thinking about it, it also was a way for me to connect with people that I normally probably wouldn't, because uh-huh. I was a homely looking kid. I mean, I wasn't the kind of kid that was, you know, popular, oh, how handsome he is, and all of that. You know, I was pretty homely and very shy,
okay,
and introvert. And so music, when I found what I would sing, people would listen, and I would become, you know, a point of interest. And that kind of turned me on, you know. So music is just, it's a partner. It's all, and it's a gift. It's not something that I created. It is a gift from God. It is a special gift. Many people ask me, hey, man, you're like 74 years old, man, and you sound like you're 16, 17 years old when you sing. I said, let me tell you something. My singing is not natural. It's supernatural. Believe me, I don't mm-hmm. even know I do the things I do with my voice. It reminds me with when Michael Jordan was playing for the championship against Indiana. And so many years ago, back in the 90s, early mm-hmm. 90s, and they triple teed him. They literally covered him. And he went back. They had like 3 to 4 seconds to go. And he fell back off his back heel and threw the ball up. Ball goes in the hoop, you know, and he raises his head like, how did I do that? It's the same with me. I, it's no way I'm supposed to sing like this. In my younger life, I was a bit of a rascal, if you read that book. I mean, I'm a street kid.
Yeah, actually, I want to talk to you a little bit about that. We're actually going to take a break now, but when we come back, mm-hmm. I want to talk to you a little bit about that early life, because you were more than a little bit of a rascal. yes. So that's where we'll go when we come back from the break. Folks, this is Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Mind Talk. Clearly having a lively conversation with the person that you may recognize as Little Anthony, Jerome Anthony Gourdin. We'll be right back.
It was not so long ago you broke my heart in two. Tears on my pillow, pain in my heart caused by on my pillow, pain in my heart.
Anthony, you were very young as you mm-hmm. hit the stage and became really quite the success. How would you say that impacted on your sense of self, your growing up?
Well, you know, actually, you know, when you're a kid and you're coming up, and then you're coming up in a situation where, you know, all of a sudden your environment changes. and then all of a sudden there's gangs. And in order to have some sense of belonging, you wanted to be like the guy, so you join the gang, and you find out this gang doesn't like that gang, and on and on and on. It's like today, man. Drive-by shootings haven't changed much because we didn't have any cars then. Nobody could afford one to even drive by. But people did some tough things. It was tough.
Well, let me ask you this.
I had to learn to live in that environment.
Let me ask you this.
But, again, I had that support system. My mom and my dad, I had a family. And they constantly, everyone constantly was on my case. And you understand, somebody once said, it takes a village to raise a child.
Yes.
Well, even in those days, our neighbors, man, it was neighbors, man, real neighbors mm-hmm. that looked out for each other.
Mm-hmm.
And they, if I did something and I was caught doing it, they said, I'm going to tell your mother. And then they would take me by the hand and bring me back to my mom. Or they even had the authority to pop me. You know what I'm saying? It was like then I go home and get popped. You know, it's something else. So I think all of that, all those situations helped me to get through this minefield called life at that time. And I never felt sorry for myself. No, because my people always instilled in me that I was somebody. There was something special. Aunt Bessie especially put that in me. That's why it's so important to be raised in families. I have a great respect for single parents and having to raise their children. And believe me, that ain't easy. But when you have the nucleus of the family that's together, that is a reflection of what society is going to be. If the family breaks down, then society is going to break down. So I had a lot of people around me that gave me enough information to get me through. A lot of my friends didn't make it. A lot of them did.
Yeah.
Got shot, got killed, something, you know, drugged out, whatever it may be. And then here I am. And that's because of the family and because I'm a faith person.
Mm-hmm.
I came up in the church. I don't know too many blacks here that didn't come up in the church. You know what I mean?
Indeed.
I talked to Aretha Franklin about that. We were laughing about that once. So we go in the dark and we get out of church and it's dark. So these things were very important for all of us that gave us something we needed. And so I don't ever feel, oh, poor me. Look what I went through, you know?
Yeah.
No. I mean, we didn't have a whole lot of money, but I didn't know we didn't have any money.
Yeah.
I didn't know. You know, we would go on boat rides. I thought that was the greatest thing in the world. My aunts would take me on a day trip up the Hudson River all the way up to Poughkeepsie or Bear Mountain, and then come back.
It's beautiful.
When we went, they had food. Oh, my goodness. My aunts put together all that food, and I loved it, man. I mean, we wouldn't do anything without food. We go to the baseball game. We have chicken. We have potato salad.
There was one point, you know, there's this concept that the kids who wind up in gangs are kids who come from dysfunctional households, single-parent families, and there's just nothing to go home to, and that's why they wind up in a gang. But you came from a loving family, an intact family, and you were in a gang for a minute or two. What wisdom can you share about why you, as a child, made that choice?
Well, you got to understand, that's another era.
Mm-hmm.
There was no cell phones. There was no internet. There wasn't nothing but where you were. And so it's a different era.
Uh-huh.
It was almost expected that you would, you know, get into the gang.
I see.
Today it's a little bit different.
Mm-hmm.
They really literally get into gangs to have a family because they don't have a family. I got in the gang because that's what you did.
Okay.
I mean, it, in your neighborhood, it was always that kind of a thing going on. My brother, Sonny, my oldest brother, started this gang called the Royales. Then they became the Chaplains. And then my brother Elliot was in the gang. My brother Donald was in the gang. And they grew up in this athlete of the gangs. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And then here I am in the neighborhood expected to do the same thing. And then also, remember, even though I had that big support system, I still had to go out in the world.
I still had to have
friends.
That's true.
And everybody that I had was a friend was in some sort of a gang. So it was almost expected. Like I said, it's a different environment. Even then, there was a thing we used to call a fair one. when the gangs would come, I mean, actually fight with hands, bottle, anything. But there was never no killing, shooting. That was a rare thing to happen.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
Okay.
And it was very, very rare.
Not like today.
And so, yeah, it was very, very rare. So it's, and so I couldn't compare that to today. Today is different.
Yeah.
It's really, really different.
And scary.
It's almost I can't put my finger on it, and I don't want to act like I'm an expert.
Sure.
I am not. But what I see and observe is something bitter. Something is more bitter about what's going on today than it was when I was a kid.
Yeah, you're right.
I mean, it was almost like a social club when I was a kid.
That's what it sounds like.
And if you got into some kind of fight or battle, or it usually was fist, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Or some kid would, but that's what we did. Today, they come in with AK-47s,
exactly,
man.
Exactly.
You know? I mean, this is some serious stuff here.
This is true.
It's like, I'm going to kill you 100 times over.
And they
that's
do.
That's hate.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I don't think we had that in us. We had more of a territorial thing.
Okay.
It wasn't about drugs. We weren't selling drugs on the street. None of that stuff I remember. Were we drinking? Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Drinking wine and all that kind of stuff. It's a totally different situation.
Totally different world. Let me ask you this. When you had your first child, fast forward from that period of your life, you had a child, and you were a child. How old were you at the birth of your first child?
My first child, I was, how old was I? 19?
So you were a baby.
And my wife, Judy was, I was a baby. We were children having children in that while. Judy, my wife at that time, she was 18. And actually, I met her when we were both, I was 15 and she was 14.
Okay.
That's 1957, yeah. Well, we were earlier than that. That was about 56. I was 15, she was 14, right?
Okay.
And we all lived in the same neighborhood and stuff. And so consequently, everybody would go out with different girls in the neighborhood.
Uh-huh.
Now, if you ventured out of the neighborhood, you do that on your own. You know, you take your life in your own hand.
Yes.
Because a lot of times, there would be some girls I really dug, but they would live in, say, Red Hook Projects.
Okay. Couldn't go there.
Where Fort Hamilton is.
Okay,
yeah.
You couldn't go there.
Yeah, and so I shouldn't go there.
I see.
but I did.
Okay.
Me and a bunch of other people chasing after little girls, you know? And so, consequently, I almost got wiped out. Yeah, it's just, that's one of the things I try to do in the book is be as accurate as I could. With Ms. Arlene Krieger to help me with the book and wrote it. Actually, I was telling her my memoirs, and it took 7 months. If I were to put everything in that book, what happened to me in my lifetime, then it would be a novel.
Gotcha.
And that wouldn't work. So there's so much that's missing that I would like. I try to put what I thought was important so when people read it, they can relate to it, you know?
Well,
but
as a kid,
I just was, just like any other teenager, man, I started smoking cigarettes.
Okay.
And I started drinking wine. I just wanted to be with the boys, you know what I mean? I just wanted to be accepted outside of my parents and my aunts. But my parents and aunts were a great place to be, too. And it was safe. It was a safe haven for me. But again, you couldn't live in that project without having some sort of a security blanket, and that's being in the gang.
Okay. You talk about in the book that by the age of 20, you had 3 children.
Oh, yeah. Now, oh, buddy. Well, you know.
Help me out.
Like what says in the Bible, go forth and be fruitful.
You
well,
were fruitful.
I took it literally.
Yeah, I hear that.
So, you know, I can remember as a small boy, I liked women. I liked ladies. I really did. Even a small kid, I loved. Remember, I'm around all these women, right?
Mm-hmm.
All my aunts and all of them, and they're doting over me.
That's right.
Right?
What's not to like?
So I'm right. See, I'm already in everybody. My cousin B, she was beautiful, man. And she don't know me. So it was mostly women that were raising me. Even though I had brothers, they were much older than me, so I couldn't relate to them.
Okay.
But I related to all the ladies. And And so that's where it was, and I was always curious. And I come to puberty, and I'm still curious. And then, you know, kids in those days, man, just like kids today, they find reading material that is not accepted. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, the Beatles starts popping. And then you figure out, oh, that's what you're supposed to do with girls. Oh, okay, you know. And I guess the little girls felt the same way. And so we would experiment, and then obviously, my first child was actually, you know what? I'm glad you said that. I just remembered. I was 18 years old when my first child was born.
Okay.
And that was a young lady named Mary McPherson.
Okay.
And my daughter, my oldest daughter, is Antoinette, out of that relationship. Now, let me try to explain it. I was already singing. I was already doing well. I was in the Apollo, and the girls, now it's not girls anymore. It's now women, you see?
Okay.
But I'm still a young man, but the women start showing up. Okay. And the women, obviously, may think, if I can hook up a little young guy, I can make life better for myself.
That's right.
And some of the old performers were hipping me, no, don't do that. Oh, hey, watch that one. Okay. Hey, watch out for that.
Okay.
And this young lady came into my life, and she was a couple of years older than me, Mary McPherson, and she was beautiful. And then we had a relationship, and then she got pregnant. And I remember it got, you know, in those days, if a girl got pregnant, you weren't married to her, it was something else.
Right.
And I remember my father saying, hey, I read the Jet magazine. That some girl pregnant. Oh boy, here we go.
That's how Dad found out, reading Jet magazine.
Dad found out reading Jet magazine. So that was like, what? No, that's not supposed to be. You got to get married. You know what I'm saying? And in the meantime, I'm a celebrity. There are women everywhere. They're just everywhere.
Yeah.
And now this homely kid, this shy kid, can have any woman he wants. I remember as a kid, I was one of my friends. I mean, he was somebody I looked up to, and he was wild. That's Jackie Wilson.
Okay.
And I used to hang with Jackie Wilson a lot. And everybody knows about Jackie Wilson. And there were women around him.
So there was nothing but women around you.
Yeah. And so I got to that point, and all of a sudden I find that I really do like women. And that's the problem, but I lost what it's supposed to be. The way my family raised me was not, they didn't raise me that way.
Right.
But I started, the street where I was in, the life that I was in was pulling me in that direction.
And the
and
life.
So now I'm, you know, and then and you know, like, I was very sheltered by my mom, very sheltered.
Okay.
As a young man. But all of a sudden I'm loose. Wow.
And it sounds like the life that you were living as a celebrity is the life that other celebrities were living as well. So you were just really kind of fitting in. Okay.
I was just mimicking them.
Okay.
You know, I wanted to be cool too. You know, oh shoot, he's got two women. I want two women too. You know, and that's how it was. Now, you know, my mother and father didn't care for this. This was rough on them.
I was about to ask you, how did mom and dad handle this?
Oh, I don't know, man. It was like my poor father, man. He was just a gentleman. He wasn't a man that was like a disciplinarian. My mother was a disciplinarian.
Mm-hmm.
My mother was on my case, you know? And she said, your dad said that there's some girl she read in the magazine that you got pregnant. It was all over New York. And that was, in those days, that was really not a good thing.
No.
You know, today it's almost like it's commonplace.
Well, it's almost expected nowadays.
Yeah, it's kind of weird. But then that wasn't the way you do. What you do is you get married. That's right. What you do, and you have children. And so here I am saying, but why? When I can have all these women anytime I want them. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
So they came. And then, here's the thing that really messed up. My family went crazy. This woman, Antoinette, in fact, I just talked to her the other day. I'm coming to New York. She wants to come to the show. But anyway, her mom, Mary, there was no relationship there now. There was nothing.
Okay.
It was just a sexual. I didn't feel like, wow, no, I'm not. She's dying. She's beautiful, but I don't have a feeling of connection.
Okay.
So Antoinette was born. You notice her name is Antoinette Anthony. Antoinette.
Gotcha.
And then finally my mother got to meet see the baby and my father. So they kind of were really cool about the baby, you know what I mean? So that kind of cooled down, and I said, okay, I'm okay. I turned right around, and had another affair with my first wife, Judy. But we were kids together. Remember, she was 14, I was 15?
Right.
At the same time, within that year, she got pregnant.
You were busy.
And then that was April. Okay, April, May, June, August. Then 3 to 4 months later, a young lady by the name of Melba Sanchez, Puerto Rican, that I really, 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 really had feelings for, really liked her a lot of fun with her. To this day, we are dear friends. She's my dearest friend. We're just friends. We always said we couldn't get married because we'd probably kill each other. We both had this strong will, you know. But she ends up getting pregnant 4 months later.
Oh my!
And now Judy finds out. Then Melba, you know, is really a woman raised with a fine family, which to this day I'm very close with. You know, all of her brother, her cousins, B&B, all them guys. I talk to them all the time. She was in a jam because her father was a merchant mariner, a Puerto Rican guy.
Okay.
And you know, Puerto Ricans is family. You know what I mean? This is not cool. So I got myself in this kind of a jam, you know? And all these babies, in the meantime, my poor mother was under all this stress.
I'm sure.
Father. But even that, they still loved me unconditionally. And they took my children under their wings. In other words, like my son Andre my son Tony. And the funny thing, my son Tony is my business manager.
Interesting. Interesting.
They used to call my mother Mama because they were around her so much, they thought that was their mother.
Interesting. Tony, we're going to take a break. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we will continue. And I'd like to fast forward to more of what's going on in your life today. Folks, This is Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Mind Talk, having a conversation with Anthony Gourdine. You know him as Little Anthony and the Imperials. We'll be right back.
Yes, I think I'm going out of my head over you.
You know, I can see the young women and the little girls falling all over themselves after they hear you sing and see you singing that song.
You know, when I'm just listening to it, and I'm saying to myself, my gosh, how blessed that I am to have worked with Teddy Randazzo, who wrote all those songs, and with the great Don Costa, who is Sinatra's arranger and a producer in many cases. I was very blessed, God. I'm just listening to stuff. And then I'll have people come around. Some disc jockey, some call. Or somebody will come up to me and say, oh, I just love the way you sing that doo-wop. And I look at them and I say, ma'am, I am not a doo-wop singer. I don't even know what a doo-wop is.
Uh-huh.
You know, I'm a contemporary R&B singer. I wasn't put into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame with a special category for doo-wop.
Gotcha.
I was put in there as an R&B singer. I did not get. Right now, I'm really looking forward to this. Got inducted into the Rhythm and Blues Hall of Fame, and it's going to be held in Detroit.
Wonderful.
And I think the Whispers are going in, Aretha Franklin, myself, a bunch of people.
You're an excellent company.
So I can't help myself.
Okay.
You know what? My mother once told me, he's keeping the David, they don't know about marriage. Because when we got married, it was forever.
That's true. You know? And that's not nowadays, if it lasts more than a week, it's a big deal. Jerome,
you gotta make me feel good. No, I don't. You have to feel good, and I'll share you feeling good, and vice versa. You know, it's the wrong way of looking at a relationship. This is a commitment.
Yeah.
But out of that commitment comes children, and they have children. See how it works? And that's not happening today. The TV, the radio, all the things, the movies, all telling you just the opposite.
That's very true. Constantly.
Do your own thing, and if you don't feel it, get you another wife. You ain't never going to find any peace.
Right.
You have to make that commitment. I'm going to make this work. And what happens is when you're married as long as we have, now I don't imagine her not being there.
Gotcha. She's just a part of your skin in so many ways.
Just a part of me now. It's who I am. It's comforting to have somebody that knows you.
Yeah, absolutely.
I can be me. You know, it's pretty cool, you know. And so maybe that helps somebody. I don't know.
Thank you very much. Again, Jerome Anthony Gourdin, known as Little Anthony, Little Anthony and the Imperials. So many of us have grown up on and lived on your music and loved your music and continue to do so.
Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service and is not intended to replace any work that you may choose to do with a medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is available on demand at mindtalk.org. You can also email me at pamela@mindtalk.org. That's mindtalk.org. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. Be sure to go to the Mind Talk homepage and sign up for our weekly free giveaway. One person will be selected every week to receive a completely free gift. And you remember always, if it's unacceptable, it's unacceptable.